From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American suburbs are familiar terrain for novelist Tom Perata. From the ruthless politics of a high school election to illicit marital affair to now, in his new book, the explosive suburban intersection of sex and evangelical Christianity. This time he takes us in deep with a conversation that is more fact than fiction for many real American towns. This hour, On Point, we're talking with Tom Perata about his new novel, The Abstinence Teacher. Joining me now from San Francisco is best-selling novelist Tom Perata. He's had high praise for his writing career. The New York Times called him the American Chekhov, and Time magazine says he's the Steinbeck of suburbia. His novels, Election and Little Children, were both picked up by Hollywood and were hits at the box office. His latest novel is The Abstinence Teacher. Tom Perata, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So this is not exactly, off into some exotic realm. This is just outside the back door, front door of most any suburban house in America, as I see it. Do you see it the same way?
I do. I live outside Boston like you do, so I think some of these issues are a little more muted. But even we in our liberal enclave over there have had some issues that are somewhat similar to this. And I think most of American people live in places where there's not a consensus around issues of sex and religion and sex education, and everything's in flux.
Tom Wolfe said, "Where are the novelists that just go out and look at what's going on in our culture, in our society right now? Do you see yourself in that mold, Tom Perata? Is that your job? Never mind the surreal or let's go for the suburban, and Tom Perata will show us what's going on."
I actually took Wolfe's point there, and I think what happened in the 2004 election, when I realized just how extreme the culture war had become and how people were living in such different realities in their red and blue states. And as a novelist, I was a little embarrassed that I really didn't know the other side of the story. I live in liberal, secular America, mm-hmm. and I just felt like it was my job to go out there and find out, not so much, the obvious surface facts, because, journalists can do that, but mm-hmm. but to get into the internal reality of people living on the other side of that divide.
It's a fascinating intersection, and I love the way you roll it out here. I wish you'd begin to introduce us to some of the players in this novel, The Abstinence Teacher. We begin with Ruth. She's kind of at the heart of the whole thing. I'm going to ask you to read in a second, but introduce us to your character, Ruth, her sort of presumptions, her cultural profile that's going to very soon in her little suburb come face-to-face with evangelism.
Yeah, well, Ruth is a product of the sexual revolution and the feminist movement. So she is a woman who came of age in the 70s and 80s and thinks that her job is to spread enlightenment about sex and to be pro-sex and to give information to people so that they can use it to lead pleasurable sex lives down the road. But also to warn them. I mean, she's not somebody just going out saying, "Hey, kids, have fun," though this is part of the controversy that happens in the novel. But I think she doesn't see anything shameful about sex, and she expects that sex is an integral part of people's lives even before they're married.
So she sees herself as a sort of a very level-headed, ordinary American, but she runs into a different kind of American, new in a way to her, at least new in her home turf there, as she's leading the sex ed class and part of the cultural bubble that goes beyond it. Now, I should say, parents, we're going to go into that sex ed class realm of American high school these days. So, gather your children and shuttle them off, because the language is going to go there a little bit too. There's an incident very early on in the book that sort of sparks everything off, where a girl stands up in class with a pretty colorful question. Ruth's not sure where she's coming from, but she presumes wrong, it turns out. Tom, I wonder if you would read for us from The Abstinence Teacher about the incident that gets the whole thing fired off.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. "Some people enjoy it." That was all Ruth had said. Even now, when she'd had months to come to terms with the fallout from this remark, she still marveled at the power of those four words, which she'd uttered without premeditation and without any sense of treading on forbidden ground. The incident had occurred the previous spring, during a contraception lecture Ruth delivered to a class of ninth graders. She had just completed a fairly detailed explanation of how an IUD works, when she paused and asked if anyone had any questions. After a moment, a pale, normally quiet girl named Teresa McBride raised her hand. "Oral sex is disgusting," Teresa declared, apropos of nothing. "You might as well French kiss a toilet seat. You can get all sorts of nasty diseases, right?" Teresa stared straight at Ruth, as if daring her to challenge this incontrovertible fact. In retrospect, Ruth thought she should have been able to discern the hostile intent in the girl's unwavering gaze. Most of the ninth graders kept their eyes trained firmly on their desks during the more substantive parts of sex ed. But Ruth wasn't in the habit of thinking of her students as potential adversaries. If anything, she was grateful to the girl for creating what her grad school professors used to call a teachable moment. "Well," Ruth began, "from what I hear about oral sex, some people enjoy it." The boys in the back of the room laughed knowingly, an attitude Ruth chalked up more to bravado than experience. Teresa reddened slightly, but she didn't avert her eyes as Ruth continued with the more serious part of her answer, in which she discussed a few basic points of sexual hygiene and described the body's ingenious strategies for separating the urinary and reproductive systems, even though they shared a lot of the same real estate. She finished by enumerating the various STDs that could and could not be transmitted through oral to genital contact, and recommending the use of condoms and dental dams to make oral sex safer for both partners. "Done properly," she said, "cunnilingus and fellatio should be a lot more pleasant and a lot cleaner than kissing a toilet seat. I hope that answers your question." Teresa nodded without enthusiasm. Ruth returned to her lecture, removing a diaphragm from its plastic case and whizzing it like a miniature frisbee at Mark Royalton, the alpha male in the back row. Acting on reflex, Mark snatched the device from the air and then let out a melodramatic groan of disgust when he realized what he was holding. "Don't be scared," Ruth told him. "It's brand new, for display purposes only."
Tom Perotta reading from his new novel, The Abstinence Teacher. And there we are, right in what anybody can imagine in a sex ed class in high school these days. But, you know, what happens in sex ed class doesn't stay in sex ed class anymore. And the culture outside is very divided over what's seen there. Tom, give us a sense in your plot line of what happens when Teresa goes to her sort of clan, culture, family, church, and shares what she heard, what the teacher said in sex ed class.
Well, what happens is that, Teresa and her family belong to an activist evangelical church, and the pastor is somebody who sees his job as actively fighting what he sees as, you know, the sinful mainstream culture, and he's very, very good, as political activists often are, in seizing on some small scandalous detail and turning it into a full-blown controversy that he can then use for his own ends.
And pretty soon it's in the local town papers and then the big city papers where the headline is, "Teacher says A-OK to oral sex," or something along those lines.
That's right. You know, and we see it all, you know, in our, you know, if you watch Fox News on the, you know, on the one side, or if you read, you know, liberal blogs on the other, you know, this is part of how the culture war gets conducted, you know, through these sort of extreme cases or offhand remarks blown out of context.
You were raised Roman Catholic, and yet you say you were sort of unaware of what was going on in the culture wars until it got so highlighted in 2004. When you went out and began to look at what's going on these days, were you surprised, Tom? Were you startled by the culture lines that are out there, or were they familiar as a kid who'd grown up Catholic?
Well, I wouldn't say that I wasn't paying attention. I think that I simply hadn't understood how things had hardened to the point where people seemed to be living in different realities. And I will say, religion was different when I was growing up Catholic. This was in the 70s. It was probably a low ebb for religion in America. And you know, for us, we'd go to church one day a week, but there really was a sense that the rest of the time was yours. And I think what's interesting about, you know, contemporary evangelical cultures, you know, people are really trying to live their faith 24 hours a day, and therefore there's a lot more conflicts, especially when they come into contact with institutions that, you know, obviously don't have the same priorities.
The twist in the book here is that liberal Ruth, to do penance for her, you know, moment of candor there with her class, is turned from a sex ed teacher into an abstinence teacher. The whole sort of format is changed. A virginity counselor is brought in, and we'll hear about that. That is not an uncommon movement, institution around this country. Did you go out and take a look at it?
I did. And you know, that one of the reasons I chose sex education as a focus for this book is just that, I've been very interested in the right's desire to fight this culture war at those places where, you know, liberal secular culture seems strongest. I mean, it seemed to me that, you know, the sexual revolution had gone so far in this country that you would not be able to sell abstinence to American teenagers. I mean, when you think about the climate that they're raised in, just how much sex is in the air, in terms of, you know, billboards, movies, TV shows, music, it seemed like a losing battle. And yet, you know, they have been able to make a lot of strides, you know, district by district. And, you know, obviously with the support of the Bush administration and the federal government.
Talking this hour with novelist Tom Perata about his new book, The Abstinence Teacher, about sex and sex ed, the Bible, suburbia. You can read an excerpt, I should say, at our website, onpointradio.org. It is right in the middle of so much that's going on in our country these days. Tom, it gets funny in a hurry here. They reach out to bring in a virginity counselor, kind of to get Ruth back on the straight and narrow, or into the straight and narrow. There's a passage here where you where she comes on the scene, is introduced to the class and to us. I wish you'd give us a read of that, if you would.
I'd be happy to. This is a school assembly. It is sexual abstinence, saying yes to saying no. So Ruth is in the auditorium watching this with skepticism. Ruth wasn't sure what kind of spokesperson she'd been expecting, but it certainly wasn't the young woman who took the stage after a warm welcome from Principal Venuti. The guest speaker wasn't just blonde and pretty. She was hot, and she knew it. You could see it in the way she moved toward the podium, like a movie star accepting an award. That consciousness she had of being watched, the pleasure she took in the attention. She wore a tailored navy blue suit with a knee-length skirt, an outfit whose modesty somehow provoked curiosity rather than stifling it. Ruth, for example, found herself squinting at the stage, trying to decide if the unusually proud breasts straining against the speaker's silk blouse had been surgically enhanced. "Good afternoon," she said. "My name is Joanne Marlowe, and I'd like to tell you a few things about myself. I'm 28 years old, I'm a Leo, I'm a competitive ballroom dancer, and my favorite band is Coldplay. I like racket sports, camping and hiking, and going for long rides on my boyfriend's Harley. Oh yeah, and one more thing, I'm a virgin." She paused, waiting for the audience to recover from a sudden epidemic of groans and snickers, punctuated by shouts of, "What a waste," and "Not for long," and "I'll be gentle," issuing from unruly packs of boys scattered throughout the auditorium. Joanne didn't seem troubled by the hecklers. It was all part of the show. "I guess you feel sorry for me, huh? But you know what? I don't care. I'm happy I'm a virgin, and my boyfriend's happy about it, too." Somebody coughed the word BS, and pretty soon half the crowd was barking into their clenched fists. It got so bad that Principal Venuti had to stand up and give everyone the evil eye until they stopped. "You probably want to know why I'm so happy about something that seems so uncool, don't you? Well, let me tell you a story." The story was about a carefree girl named Melissa, whom Joanne had known in college. Melissa slept around, but figured it was okay, because the guys always used condoms. One night, though, when she was having safe sex with this handsome stud she'd met at a bar, a guy she didn't know from Adam, the condom just happened to break, as condoms will. "The guy looked healthy," Joanne explained, "but he had AIDS. Melissa's dead now, and I'm alive. That's reason number one why I'm glad to be a virgin."
The virginity coach speaks to the school assembly in Tom Perata's The Abstinence Teacher. Tom, you had every option in the world. You chose to make the virginity coach blonde, pretty, and not just pretty, hot. Why?
I'm not the only one, Tom. You know, I went recently to a Silver Ring thing.
Explain what that is.
The Silver Ring is the group that basically promotes abstinence, but also gets kids to put on a ring on their, you know, wedding finger hand. That they're supposed to keep on as a pledge to remain pure and chaste until marriage. And I went with a New York Times reporter who wanted me to go because I'd never actually gone to an event like this before writing the book. And sure enough, a pretty blonde woman got up and talked about, you know, how hard it was to get through college. She was wearing very tight clothes and, you know, was really proud of herself as a beautiful woman and was saying, you know, guys were trying to get me, but they couldn't, you know, and there was this sort of militant sense of virginity about her. And of course, this is a really interesting part of the strategy now. I think what a lot of evangelicals are trying to erase is that old church lady image, you know, the old woman shaking her hand saying, don't have fun, don't do that. You know, they're trying to make it, they're trying to say, you know, look, you can wait, but you can still be sexy. You don't have to sacrifice that part of your life. And, you know, Joanne says this as well. She says, you know, I found this perfect guy. He respects me. When we get married, it is going to be so great. And there's this sort of fairy tale that's the payoff. It's like a heaven on earth thing. If you just wait till you're married, you know, you're going to have great sex.
This seems to be, to me, a little bit more in that reality in your portrayal than just, you know, we're not dowdy old church ladies anymore. I mean, there's almost an active play with the sexual tension between that sexy, hot presentation and the message.
I think there is, you know, and it was really, I think, you know, that the young woman, you know, the Ann Coulter type, the sort of sexy right winger has become a really interesting new figure on the cultural landscape. And I think it's, you know, to some degree, both the Christian right and the political right, not quite certain if it wants to be countercultural or to co-opt certain, you know, energies in the mainstream, because it's hard to fight sexiness. So you might as well just become sexy.
Right, there it is. You know, I want to ask, in the front piece of the book, you quote from the Bible's New Testament, from the Gospel of Mark. You quote him like this, "And if anyone," this is his presentation of Jesus speaking, "and if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around his neck." There's a dictate to be tough on the corruptors. Are you judging in this book? What attitude did you come in with? What attitude did you come out with?
I tried not to judge. I mean, I think someone like Joanne is a sort of a figure of fun.
The virginity coach.
The virginity consultant. I think Tim Mason, the main Christian character, I hope is very sympathetically portrayed. And he's a character who I really came to like and respect over the course of the
book. Former rocker who's become a born-again evangelical.
Right. Like a lot of people I know who've become Christians, you know, he was somebody who you know, whom religion helped to get back on his feet. And he's been inspired and challenged by Pastor Dennis, who I mentioned in a previous reading. And the pastor is just a very uncompromising fundamentalist Christian. So the pastor will look at, you know, an admonition like the one you just quoted from the Gospel of Mark and just say, this is our job as Christians. You know, if somebody's corrupting our kids, we've got to stand up. We've got to fight. You know, Pastor Dennis also puts Tim in a position later in the book where he's doing things that are in, you know, that go against his custody agreement because Tim is divorced and has a 10-year-old daughter. And again, you know, Jesus in the Bible says, I come to separate parents from children. I mean, there's a sense that this is a very radical and uncompromising path. And I think that's what the pastor, I don't think he's a bad Christian. I think that he is accepting the challenge of the Gospels.
But you're tweaking along the way. Maybe this is just a novelist's fun, but the abstinence teacher, the virginity consultant, is the hottie. Pastor Dennis is the former Best Buy, you know, big box appliance store salesman.
And you have the liberal sex education teacher, Ruth, who has a miserable sex life. She just hasn't had any fun in a long time. And you have the Christian guy, Tim, who's trying to be on the straight and narrow, but his life is always much too interesting. So I think I'm very interested in there's this division, and we live in different realities, but we also encompass a lot of contradictions, each of us.
Conversation gets very interesting between Ruth and Tim in that case, but let's hear from our listeners before we get there. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, Tom. We have Anna on the line. Hi, Anna. You're on the air with Tom Parada.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I haven't heard the whole thing. The reason why I'm calling, I am an educator.
Mm-hmm.
currently I'm sick is the reason why I sound so bad, and another reason why I'm calling during the school time.
We're glad you're home to hear and call, Anna.
Well, actually, I had to pull over. I just came from the doctor's office.
Oh, get better soon. What do you think?
Well, the issue that I have is that there's so many parents who do not take the time to give their own children sex education. As a Christian person, we should train our children up, give them all the information. What's happening in this world, in this real world, is the children are not getting the information that they need. In the county that I work, if we mention any other safe sex practices other than abstinence, we can not only be fired, but be sued.
Do you, so you're a sex ed teacher, are you also?
No, I am not a sex ed teacher.
Oh, I see,
teacher.
I see, okay.
I am a teacher, I'm not a sex ed teacher. Guidance counselors, no one in our county can give children any information, nor can they give them any direction for sex education other than abstinence.
Anna, that's interesting. If I may ask you, just because it's the line that runs through Tom Perotta's book, where do you put yourself in religious terms? Are you a church-going person, or are you even Christian, or are you an evangelical?
I call myself a church-going person. I am a Christian. I do believe in the Trinity. I have a problem whenever people use Christianity as a shield to do whatever they'd like. So I kind of stray away from saying Christian. I say I'm a Trinity believer, church-going person.
Let me ask you then, in Tom's book, he has the sex ed teacher, Ruth, who's kind of the, you know, liberal, secular sex ed teacher. Question comes up about oral sex, and she, one phrase she uses, among many other things she says, is some people enjoy it. Does that sound off the reservation to you? Wrong? Fireable offense?
I'm not saying sex is bad. Sex is wonderful. Whichever way you want to practice is your own personal choice between yourself and your partner. That I don't have an issue with. What I have an issue with is children who do not know what they're about to get into, and they get themselves into situations and they do not know how to protect themselves. I'm not saying that condoms are the right way always. I'm not saying that abstinence is a bad thing. What I am saying is if our parents would stand up and teach our children, which they don't, it would be a different story. But I don't see laws so strongly against educators giving children information. Children look to us, our students look to us as wellsprings of information.
But in your county, if a teacher stands up and gives that beyond abstinence, that teacher may be soon out of a job. And Anna, feel better. Thanks for your call. Let me go to Sister Helen Marie, calling from Boston. Sister Helen Marie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm from the Center of Light in Boston, and it's a mystical Christian school. And
what does that mean, a mystical Christian school?
It's an inner path. So we are mystics, so we seek an experience of God inside of us.
Is it Roman Catholic?
No, it's non-denominational.
Okay, so a sister in a different school. All right, what do you think?
So I would like to get into, like, the heart of the matter. I had sex at a very young age and continue to have sex throughout my life. And sex did feel good temporarily. You know, it helped the pain sometimes, and sometimes there was deep loving connection between me and my partners, and a lot of times there wasn't. And there was a lot of pain inside. And so talking about the external stuff, you know, wearing condoms, protection, education, all those things are really important. Also, to be real and to talk about our feelings about sex. How do we feel after we have sex? Is it something that feels good temporarily, but then does the sadness go away? Does the pain go away? And so a lot of it is, you know, for me personally, that's what it felt like for me. It filled a part in my life that was trying to escape pain often. And then sometimes there was a real loving, pure exchange between two people, which is a different feeling inside.
Can you teach abstinence, pure and simple, and speak to those deeper issues of the profound kind of resonance of sexuality?
Yeah, yeah. There's there's a deeper love that goes on, but most of the time it is just kind of an external kind of feel good temporarily, you know, to kind of cover something up.
Yep.
And that's what my experience was in it. So virginity is a radical path. Anyone that's attempting to have abstinence and go against the whole cultural norm, they're doing a radical thing. And to have that experience is a whole nother thing. So I call on people to try it, to see where it leads them in their hearts and in their minds and in bringing peace to the earth. It's a radical thing to do, and I totally admire that.
And Sister Hill Maria, we've got that perspective, and I'm grateful for it, and thank you very much for calling. Tom Perotta, I want to ask about your sympathies as you worked through this. I mean, you've got a kind of a, you can put on a wise guy eye. You had fun with high school elections, kind of satirical take on the ruthlessness there. You looked at suburban infidelity and the pressures and desires that work in adults there. Our caller, Sister Helen Marie, raises an important point that Americans wrestle with. We had a period of pretty open sexuality, but not necessarily spiritual happiness. Did you find yourself in some sympathy with these evangelicals that you portray, you know, trying to, I don't know, get a grip on it, get a handle on it, even put it in a box? But could you understand why?
Sure I can. And I was actually really interested in what Sister was just saying, because I think, as a novelist, I was really interested in that, in private behavior as well as, you know, what Ruth says publicly. You know, her sex life has not been a happy one, and the book's very clear about that. And I wanted to talk about, you know, how she had sex for the first time and why she had sex for the first time. I mean, I think there's this public debate on the one hand, and then there's this wealth of private experience that, you know, we haven't fully assimilated as a culture, whether that's, you know, exciting, great sex, you know, transformative sex, which is a myth that you know, is out there in the culture and a reality for some people. Or what she said, you know, sex that is meant to, you know, distract you from your existential pain. I think that I also was interested in the first caller, because I my problem here is I don't mind abstinence as a possible path for people. But I do worry that along with abstinence comes a kind of a return to repression, a desire to make people less thoughtful and less autonomous in terms of their choices. Just say, here's the path, get on it, don't ask, don't know. You know, I mean, it's that part, the sort of enforced ignorance that seems to be part of that agenda that worries me. I actually do think it's, you know, you'd like to be ready. It's just hard to know what it means to be ready.
We're talking this hour with novelist Tom Perotta about his new book, The Abstinence Teacher, about sex, sex ed, the Bible, suburbia, American culture. Robert's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Now, I just wanted to bring up the contradictions between Massachusetts and a state like Tennessee, because I lived in Massachusetts for 15 years in Amherst and then down on the South Shore.
Let's hear it.
I have four daughters. Three of them are teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm in a lot of trouble.
But what
I found in Massachusetts was that, you know, you didn't really bring up discussions of sex education, whether it was offensive or defensive, because there was a social blanket of acceptance, and people did what they did, and I guess everybody expected to deal with the consequences.
You mean sex ed, so, just, it must be, it must go forward, it will go forward.
Well, if it was there, it might be there, it might not be there, but I think mm-hmm. the parents took a much greater role in, you know, edifying their children. And down here in Tennessee, I live in the Nashville district, and one of my daughters goes to a high school where
mm-hmm.
They almost, you know, it's such a fundamental blanket of ideology, but at the same time, the contradiction is that she goes to school with a lot of girls who are, you know, pregnant or have had children, and in the morning sometimes they make announcements, not celebrating it to a degree, but even bringing up that they might have showers, you know, baby showers for these students.
So-and-so is having a baby shower, so-and-so is it's being celebrated?
Yeah, in a high school.
Well, okay, so in the context of what kind of abstinence teaching or otherwise, Robert, something went on there.
Well, I guess they do teach sex education, but not enough. And in, you know, response to what one of your other callers was saying, the Christian parents, and especially the fundamental Christian parents, don't even want to talk about it with their children. I guess maybe there's some that do, but maybe just the climates are much different from up north and down here.
Are you sympathetic with people there where you're living in Nashville wanting to, I don't know, keep it out of the public schools, keep it in their churches, in their families, or not?
No, I... You know, I think that all parents should, you know, approach it differently. You know, how to, you know, in terms of religion, I'm kind of a believer in exile, I guess. You know, it's hard to find the books that I want to read in the libraries around here. But at the same time, you know, in the neighborhood that we live in, the parents, you know, I know they don't talk about it with their kids. So.
Yep. Robert, thanks very much for that report, and good luck with your four daughters and everything that life brings. Thanks very much for calling. Tom Parada, you can hear how people struggle with this in different communities in different parts of the country, everybody in their family life. In the book, The Abstinence Teacher, you have Ruth really come kind of head-to-head with Tim, the rocker-turned-evangelical. Ruth has a couple of daughters. One of them is on the soccer team that Tim coaches. And there's a moment here when the girls have been playing a game and... prayer comes into it. Tim brings his belief into his role as soccer coach with Ruth's daughter. I wish you'd read that for us.
Sure. This is at the end of a hard-fought game, and among other things, Tim's daughter was sort of knocked out, and there was a moment when it looked like she was seriously hurt, but then she got to her feet. So it's been a very emotional game. I just should say that that's the context here. And Ruth is walking across the field to say goodbye to her daughter after the game. The stars hadn't done their cheer yet. They were sitting cross-legged in a circle on the grass, holding hands, looking unexpectedly solemn as they listened to whatever it was Tim Mason and assistant coach John Roper were telling them. The coaches were part of the group, and that just made it cuter, the two grown men holding hands with the complete lack of self-consciousness they'd displayed while dancing at halftime, until Ruth suddenly realized what they were doing, at which point it wasn't cute at all. "Excuse me," she called, quickening her pace. "Just a minute." Several girls turned at the sound of her voice, including Maggie. Ruth caught the warning look in her daughter's eyes, the silent plea for her to just please keep out of this, but she didn't slow down. Tim Mason ignored her approach. He kept his eyes on the ground and spoke in a low voice. "And all the blessings he has bestowed upon us, our parents, our families, all the material..." "Hello," Ruth interrupted. "You can't do this." The coach stopped talking and looked up. "This is ridiculous," Ruth continued. "These aren't your children." The glance he returned wasn't defiant, but it was calm and unwavering. "Join us," he said. "You're more than welcome." "Maggie," Ruth said, her voice harsher than she meant it to be. "You get away from there." "Mom," said Maggie. "Ruth," said John Roper, "calm down." Tim Mason looked at Maggie. "She needs to hear this," he said. "So do you." "You don't know me," Ruth told him. "Don't tell me what I need." "You're no different from anyone else," he replied. "We all need the same thing."
We all need the same thing, says the evangelical soccer coach to the liberal, one-time sex ed teacher turned abstinence teacher in Tom Parada's new book, The Abstinence Teacher. Ruth offended by the presumption there, his presumption in praying with her daughter, with whom she doesn't really pray, his presumption in projecting need onto her.
Yeah, and of course the irony being that, this accusation, "These aren't your children, you have no right to inflict your values and your practices on them," is, you know, precisely the accusation that the evangelical church people leveled against Ruth.
But of course, it's not long in the book, just within a few pages here, Ruth learns, kind of to her horror, that her daughters are hearing the siren song of this new culture in her town. In fact, they're sort of going over to it. They're getting into the tabernacle message, the evangelical message. They're ready to accept Jesus as their savior and all the rest. And now she's really got a lot on her plate.
Yeah, it's in the same way that I think, Christian parents feel somewhat, besieged by messages of say, sexuality or, you know, portrayals of gay people in the media or whatever, you know, Ruth quickly comes to feel somewhat besieged by, proselytizing Christians in her town, and they're beginning to make some headway on her daughters. And now, to Ruth's credit, I think she really does believe that kids have to make their own choices. And this is, like, I think, one of the fundamental differences across the cultural divide. You know, Ruth believes in, you know, you are an autonomous moral agent, and you have to make your own choices. So when her daughters say they're going to go to church, she doesn't like it, and she argues with them, but she ultimately lets them go. You know, she's willing to surrender that control and let them find out for themselves.
And here we are, right in the middle of where America is in many ways right now. Let's take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Joyce, you're on the air with Tom Parada.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have watched my college friends, 20 years out of school now, go into the various camps. And we have some who have gone whole hog into the evangelical side of religion and adopted it and embraced it and become almost people that I didn't know 20 years ago. And then I watched other people who have gone so far to the left. And there's very few, like me, who are in the middle here, who understand that our children need this education, but they don't need to be taught perhaps as much as what Ruth does in the book, and listening to the author read has been wonderful for me. But it's just, I'm living it, and down here in South Carolina, as your caller from Tennessee said, there is a little bit more of the religion-tinged education if parents talk at all to their children about it.
How does it feel in that middle ground, Joyce? Is there a middle ground? Is there a place for you to sit, to stand there?
I had middle ground when I was in school 25 years ago. Why does it seem to be so difficult now for us to find that middle ground again? Why can't there be a biology aspect to sex education without having to have all of the how-tos? I understand you need to know the correct way to put on a condom, forgive me for saying that on air, but it just seems to me that the biological aspects of it need to be stressed to our children. They need to understand what can happen to them physically if they are to take this step. Teaching them how to do it, I don't think, personally belongs in our schools. I don't want anyone teaching my daughter how to do it in public school.
Joyce, thanks very much for that. And Tom Parada, having seen vocabulary lists come home from sex ed classes in school and having my sort of eyes, you know, pop out at some of what was being taught there. On the other hand, you don't want ignorant children on something so fundamental to human nature. Joyce is calling in sex ed for some kind of middle ground. And you had to work through the relations in this book. You had to think about the bigger cultural polarity as well. I mean, did you find middle ground to put in the mouths of your characters or not?
Let me just start by saying, you know, I know what you're saying about the middle ground. I grew up in the 70s, and it amazes me. I occasionally check out this story with people I went to school with. There was a kid who basically was, his friends saw him masturbating through their window one night. They were like peering into his room, and he got like drummed out of our school. He basically was mocked so mercilessly.
Humiliated right out the door.
And there was just this sense, I remember a few years later hearing Dr. Ruth on the radio say, you know, it's okay. Everybody does it. It's a part of human life. You know, there shouldn't be any shame around this. And I remember thinking, like, it's a little too late for us. And so I just want to, you know, remind people of, you know, what it can be like. And, you know, imagine for gay people then as well. And all these things are fraught with morality. So we might say, well, masturbation or homosexuality is a fact of life. But if you're religious, you might take issue with that. So it's really hard to say, oh, this is neutral biological information.
But Joyce says, you know, yes, it's always complicated, but it seems more polarized. And, of course, it's a common observation now. Which brings me back to that curiosity about what you imagined or found in the effort to create a kind of middle ground conversation. Is it possible?
Well, I mean, I think that was sort of the ultimate purpose of the novel, was to get Ruth and Tim talking. And, you know, they're both, I think, reasonable people with complex experiences of life. And you know, their middle ground has to do with adult things, you know, with the fact that they're divorced parents trying to raise kids as best they can, that they're struggling to find happiness, that they have histories that they wouldn't necessarily share with their kids. I think it's a particular, you know, interesting facet of this conversation and this novel is that, you know, because our generation, the generation that's parents now, lived through a particularly turbulent time. And, you know, I think they're having a hard time figuring out how to use their experience to teach their kids.
What to share and what to censor.
Yeah, a lot of people I know are afraid to tell their kids about, you know, what they did and when they did it and what it was like. And so it's become a kind of, you know, there's a whole other level of shame that doesn't have to do with, you know, the facts of life, but with the facts of autobiography.
Maybe shame, maybe learning. Let's go to Justin in Houston, Texas. Hi, Justin, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, thank you. I want to say now that this caller, this man, this is say, I think very important that, you know, that the parents get to teach the kids and get to talk about their experiences. And a lot of this, I think, sex education school derives from parents that don't talk to their kids. The kids that, you know, they don't have the access, they don't have the information, and it's just a way for the schools to step up and uniformly offer that service to them. Now, whether it should be optional for the parents to allow their kids to do it, now I think that's a different argument. But the education definitely needs to be there because the some of the scare tactics that are on the extreme, whether it be religion or with even in family, sometimes might counter the biology aspect of it. I mean,
but what should be the message in the teaching, Justin? You know, here's the wherefore and how to, or abstinence?
I think that's the extreme. I think the where to and how to do it and vocabulary of certain extreme circumstances might be the opposite end. I think that they need to know that it's a natural thing. I think that it needs to be the sexuality needs to be expressed to them and then their feelings need to be explained, whether if it is the direction of abstinence, they need to go to abstinence in order to be one with their religion and with their family and peers, then that's something that they need to make the choice. But the fact that they do have the choice needs to be expressed to them, and the plus and minuses of both sides.
Yep.
I think one thing that stuck with me over the years is the struggle. You know, a young child, a child having a child, you know, 13, 14 years old, they're going to have a baby that's financial support, it's medical support, it's their struggle, the strain that it's going to put on their life. Not so much of, I think that clicked more with me as a child rather than what I was going to be appeared at in God's eyes, because then you teach the God perspective and the religion perspective. Well, then where do you draw the line of, okay, this was a problem and this is unacceptable in religion, and then you still embrace life and happiness and a baby, and where is that fine line drawn when it's always wrong? You don't want a 14-year-old mother thinking that the child she's going to have is unacceptable.
Yeah, Justin, a lot of potential struggles you're pointing at there, and I thank you for your call. Tom Perotta, our time grows short, but I'm fascinated at the what conclusions you may have pulled away from this. If a novelist, I know you're not obligated to reach conclusions, but does it look like a permanent rift, or does it look just like a complicated sort of cultural moment in America's cultural dance here? Is there room for the society to sort of get knitted back together here, or do you see a two-nation path?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think the book basically shows how it's possible for two individuals to come to know and care about each other. And that seems to be, you know, an important first step in coming to some sort of understanding. I'm no sociologist, but I think there's been a study that basically shows it doesn't matter to some degree what kids are taught, whether they're taught comprehensive sex education, abstinence sex education. It seemed not to have any effect on the age when they had sex or whether or not they used birth control. So in some funny way, the debate is simply about values that are being expressed, that it's not seeming to have all that much effect on behavior. And you can look at that as in a way, a way out of the discussion, that this is really about parents and not about kids. But that doesn't solve our problems.
The kids will find their way. Nature will find its way. Tom Perata, you always bring an interesting perspective to those burbs where most of America lives these days. And we thank you for the latest, The Abstinence Teacher. Tom, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Tom Perata, novelist, joined us from San Francisco. His new book is The Abstinence Teacher. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.